So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to our series of talks here in the CCCB, the Berlin residence of the Chaos Computer Club. Welcome to Datengarten number 92. Today we have some really cool topic about, well, housing, 3D printing, and whoever, especially here in Berlin, has ever had contact with this really nice housing market might find this quite interesting. So tonight we have our speakers here, Mary Dallenbaugh-Losse and Jens Meissner. A warm welcome, please. And they will talk about, well, 3D printing, tiny houses, the public commons, and soon after this, we will have a Q&A session where I have this microphone and will come to you individually to record your questions so that we have this question on recording and on the stream. And yeah, let's see how this will go. And I wish you all have fun. And again, warm welcome to Mary and Jens.
Thank you so much. Just to maybe give a quick outline of our talk today. First, Jens will speak about fun tech and open source things, so about 3D printing, and that will be the majority of the talk. And at the end, I will be very happy to link these to the affordable housing crisis and potential ways that we could develop some open source land rights, not only open source housing printing, 3D printing, etc.
Okay.
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 I'm gonna have a seat.
So let's start. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today about 3D printing houses. I looked into, I start resetting. I looked at projects and printers in that are available at the moment. I don't have all of them, but I try to get as much as possible for you. So I start up with clarifying additive and subtractive manufacturing. There are actually two new words used since the millennium, and however, these are actually also old manufacturing methods are in this categories or in this in the sections. So additive manufacturing or AM refers on any way of adding together material. So the old versions are bricklaying, stucco plastering, weaving, pottery, and cake decorating, which is very close actually to 3D printing as well. Subtractive manufacturing is a process in which 3D objects are constructed by successively cutting material away from a solid block of material. So it's carving, stonemason, carpentry, and stone and wood sculpting. 3D printing. One modern version of additive manufacturing is 3D printing. 3D printing at a construction scale can be divided into three main methods. You have extrusion using concrete, cement, wax foam, polymers, clay as filaments, or you powder bonding using polymer bond, reactive bond, or you sintering things together. And the third version is additive welding. A number of different approaches have been demonstrated to date, which includes on-site and off-site fabrication of buildings and construction components using industrial robots, gantry systems, and autonomous vehicles. So this includes fabrication of houses, construction components like cladding, structural panels, and columns, bridges and civil infrastructures, artificial reefs, prototyping in research, like the moon station is in planning, and creating of art sculptures. That's more my thing, what I do in my spare time, and much more. Before I show you the current projects and printers of 3D printing houses, I want to have a look into history. So I start with the 50s, and the first approach was, of course, bricklaying. And that has been conceptualized and explored in the 50s. Related technologies development around automated construction began then in the 1960s, in example with pumped concrete and isocyanate foams. Development of automated fabrication of entire building using slip form techniques and robot assembling assembly of components akin to 3D printing were pioneered in the 80s and 90s in Japan. And that was Shimizu and Hitachi addressed with it with the danger of, or they addressed actually the danger of building high-rise buildings. Many early approaches of house building automation, however, was founded because there have been several crises. We have one right now as well. In the mid-80s, though, the inability to respond to new architectures, the digitalization of designs hasn't been there yet, so you couldn't apply it to the environment, for example, the designs. And that's also one of the problems, was feeding and preparing materials to the site in a build-up area. So, what it says, 95 to 2000, in 5 years, there was two methods. The first method was invented by Joseph Pegner. It focused on a cement forming technique, which utilizes steam to selectively bond the material in layers or solid parts. It is now known as solid freeform construction. The second method invented by Benrock initially began as a Novik ceramic extrusion and shaping method as an alternative to emerging polymer and metal 3D printing techniques, and was patented in 1995. Today known as contour crafting. Around 2000, Kozhinevich's team at the USC Vertibi began to focus on construction scale 3D printing of cementitious or ceramic paste. The team explored a continuous build process to integrate modular reinforcement, built-in plumbing, and electrical services. I will talk a little bit, or I will show later an example of that. In 2003, Robert Saw secured the funding and formed the Freeform Construction Group and Loughborough University in UK to explore the potential of upscaling of existing 3D techniques for bigger construction applications. In 2005, the group built a large-scale construction 3D printing machine using off-the-shell components, which is actually then is a good point about open sourcing it. Concrete pumping, spray concrete and gantry system, all was from the shelf and was put together to create this form there. Looks a bit like a termite form shape. In 2005, Enrico Dini from Italy patented D-shaped technology, employing a massively scaled powder jetting and bonding technique of an area approximately 6 to 6 by 3 meter. This technology, or this technique, although originally developed in the epoxy resin bonding system, was later adapted to use inorganic bonding agents. this technology has been has been used commercially for a range of projects in the construction and other sectors, including the example of artificial reefs. One of the latest developments or latest examples is this beautiful bridge in Madrid that has been then the first of its kind. So in 2008, Richard Buswer and his colleagues began 3D concrete printing in Lowbury University in UK. It extended the group's prior research by moving from a gantry system to an industrial robot to have this form, this kind of shapes, because the robot has better movements. In 2013, James B. Gardiner and Stephen Jansson invented FreeFab Wax. The technique uses construction scale 3D printing to print high volume of engineered wax up to 400 liters an hour. It fabricates a fast and dirty 3D printed mold and with precast concrete. For precast concrete, glass fiber, reinforced concrete, or other sprayable and castable materials. The first commercial available gantry 3D print system is available since 2013. It's Bedebram. It's a very simple gantry based concrete extrusion printer and has been developed in Slovenia. It offers three different models, seen on the right side there. And the biggest, the P1 on the right side, is then 16 to 9 to 2.5 meters in size. In 2014, Andriy Rudenko built a construction 3D prototype. He called it Stroybot. And he constructed actually this tiny castle there in his backyard, I think. And but continued actually improving his printer, and on the right side you have an example that was in 2015. He built actually a complete hotel suite in the Philippines, Louis Grant Hotel. So X3E is a project launched in July 2015. A developed technology is based on a robotic arm that extrudes fresh concrete. Again, concrete. X3E is now a 3D printing service company based in France that develops house 3D printing technologies for the architectural design, engineering, and in the construction field. And the recent 3D printed tree shape like structure is seen on the bottom on the right side by pouring concrete cast in a special mold. Zvikavia is a company based in Russia and is the world first company or a group of, because later it becomes a group that launches serial production of 3D printers, a gantry system as well. In May 2015, the company introduced the first model of construction 3D printer to the market. In August of 2017, the first construction printer was delivered to Europe, to Denmark, to a project that I will show you later on. It is called the BOD, or BOD, and it's the first printed building in the EU. And the beginning of 2018, this group of companies called an AMT, Specavia or Specavia, produced seven different models of portable construction printers. Back to 2015, also China, Winsun, a Chinese company, has demonstrated the efficiency of technology by constructing a five-storage or a five-story apartment building and a 1,100 square meter villa in their industrial area to show off their technique. The 3D printer array developed by Ma Yi, who has been inventing 3D printers over a decade, stands 6.6 meters in height, 10 meters wide, and 40 meters long, and it's in their facility. So they actually pre-produce the parts, and then they send them over and get assembled on the construction site. out of their own advertisement, they say the process saved 30 to 60% construction waste, decreases production time in 50 to 70%, and the labor costs are down 50 to 80%. So, yeah, May 2016, new office building was opened in Dubai. I like that. That version very much of 3D printed building. It's a 250 square meter space, and it is what Dubai's Museum of the Future project is called, the first 3D printed office building. One of the first building in Europe is the BOD. That's that what actually I was talking about before. It is a small office hotel building with a 3D printed wall and foundation structure. The gantry system was produced by Spekavia, this Russian company I already mentioned. Okay, up to 2018. The city of Eindhoven in Netherlands will build the first habitable homes made by a 3D printer on the right side there. It will be finished in mid of next year, 2019. The project is realized by Rudy van Gorp and Goa Gorp, who's working in collaboration with Eindhoven University of Technology. The 3D printer being used is essentially a huge robotic arm with a nozzle that skirts out specifically formulated cement. And the team hopes in the development to develop a new method that will implement or embed drainage pipes and other necessary installation while printing. You can see that actually they have this role there. They try to actually implement it into the print already, like wires as well. So the next section, let's come to the current printers and projects that are going on at the moment, and beside that one before. Before, I have three sections I want to subdivide this. There's the on-site construction using mobile print units, on-site construction using gantry printing systems, and off-site fabrication with on-site assemblies then afterwards. The collection contains commercial I mean, unfortunately, there is actually no open source house 3D printer right now, which would be actually call up to everyone who is interested. So the collection contains commercial, non-profit, and prototypes to show you a variety of existing printer and projects. However, I will show you one related open source project at the end that uses actually subtractive manufacturing. Okay, first section, on-site construction with mobile vehicles or units. Fastbrick Robotics, an Australian-based technology company, has created the Hadrian X construction system. It combines the conventional method of bricklaying and new robotic technology. So it essentially creates a house brick by brick, layer by layer, in a very fast, accurate, and high-efficient way, and in a totally automated fashion, they say. It is controlled by a network of computers, robot vision cameras, servo motors, and the laser tracker to monitor the length position of the bricks. We'll be able to approximately lay 1,000 bricks an hour in comparison for 24/7 In comparison, a worker, a bricklayer can do 300 to 400 a day, so it is quite a fast improvement of creating houses. The machine uses an industrial adhesive instead of a traditional mortar, which also increases the structure 4 to 5 times, increase the thermal and acoustic efficiency of a building by up to 70%, and further decreases the build time as there are no delays in waiting for the mortar to dry. The compensation system cancels out movements caused by wind or vibration, so the accuracy of the bricklaying continues or stays stable. The brick sizes are 50 to 25 centimeter maximum. So the Abscore 3D printer is a house 3D printer made by Abscore, a manufacturer based in Russia. They did, however, advertise it in the US. This house 3D printer can be very easily transported by an LKW or in a truck. The printer is almost fully automated, though it needs to have two people to run and operate it, to supply it with material. It has a stabilization system as well, so the printer can be installed almost on any surface that is less than 10 centimeters difference, so it can be adjusted and configured. The printer cuts down the cost about 40% compared to traditional building techniques. Next one. The 3D Constructor is a house 3D printer made by Machines 3D, a manufacturer based in France. It's quite similar. It can be transported very easily because it has extension arms that goes outwards. You can see that down here. So there's one from MIT, a digital construction platform. Is a prototype designed and developed by MIT students. The robot arm system has a radial reach of more than 10 meters. Development to explore the potential for one-side fabrication. An architectural test print has been made. I have it in the video. You can see it actually on the video later on if we are on that. And it's kind of an open dome, and it has been printed then in 13 and a half hours. And the next one is BuddyPrint 3D, also a robot, prints large-scale molds by depositing polyurethane layer by layer to form a shallow support structure. And the form structure then serves as a formwork for a third layer of other materials like concrete to stabilize it. There's Cyber 3DP, consists also, I think, it's actually a single robotic arm with a nozzle at the end. It's easy to move. It's capable of reach up to 2.75 meters and requires only two people again to operate it. And the Casa X1, I saw that video. I really like how it looks like, but it seems it's just momentarily just rendered. So I'm not really sure if this thing really exists or if it's still just in the mind of people. So that's... and then I have... This one I really liked actually, because it does hack the existing vehicles, and with an addition of this head on the front here, also in the video to see, it uses actually low tech practice of building homes using earth bags, seems to be keeping pace with the most up to date 3D technologies. The Earth Home Builder is a skid-operated machine that can 3D print entire homes by filling earth bags, tubes, at the rate of 122 meters an hour. That comes then on the one side out, you fill it up there, it goes there through, and you actually drive the vehicle alongside, so that can actually, you are the 3D printer and a bit of it, at least. So the next section is gantry systems. Gantry system you can have actually in facilities, or you can transport them to the site and assemble them there and use them then there. It's depend on what is better or what is more efficient, because the transport of the material to the gantry system or to the site, or actually producing it somewhere and then take the parts to the site and assemble it there. But again, it's probably depend on the design and how efficient is one way or the other. So the contour crafting also, I mentioned that before in the history part, or in the history section. It's a construction 3D printing company from US. This company aims to 3D print sustainable houses using gantry cranes in order to help people after natural disasters. That's one of their motivations. Contour crafting also 3D prints buildings, infrastructures, and works on these space stations for Mars and Moon for NASA. Since 2017, they have also started selling these printer systems. That's again one close to my heart. It's the Big Delta Wasp from Italy. It's a printer that has 12 meters high, it's 7 meters wide, and is assembled with 6 meter long arms. It is actually is a scale up of a really traditional one version of a traditional 3D printer. It works with all components of the printer have a maximum length of 3 meters, so it is also again a part. It's very easy to transport. It works with 220 volts, but it also can work with 60 volts, as the engines and electric parts have been realized to be powered by solar panels. Free counter measure reset weights balance the system, so it allows to reduce the consumption powers again about 1 kilowatt. It can move an extruder with cargo up to 200 kilograms and has the current maximum speed of 40 centimeters a second. It is designed to print with organic materials. They use actually clay, a clay mixture, or with concrete. Icon, actually a child of some guys from, a non-profit organization creates a prototype of mobile printer for News Story, which is also an organization. The product version of the printer will have the ability to print a single-story home of about 183 to 244 square meters in under 24 hours for less than $4,000. As a part of this effort, Icon has developed cutting-edge materials tested to the most recognized standards of safety, comfort, and resilience. It is designed to function with nearly zero waste production methods and works under unpredictable constraints like limited water, power, and labor infrastructure to tackle housing shortages. Local labor will also operate the machines, creating new advanced manufacturing jobs. For home and community initiatives to be successful, they must be designed with the input of people who will be living in them. So it's also one of their calls is participatory design. And the showcase was unveiled in March 2000, 18 in Texas. Again, one project I like as well is the Tree Dome. Tree Dome is actually a retrofit kit prototype created to be mounted on a simple or conventional static or mobile crane. It is basically turned an existing crane into a robotic arm, where a crane does 80% of the work, while the tripod frameless Delta does the other 20%. The three arms try to compensate the rough movements of the crane and vibrations or wind. I'm not aware if this prototype has been taken on and continues the development, but I found it is a very nice idea to think through. So, while many robots and gantry system can be generally also be used for in-house construction, is mainly up to the architectural designs or the overall efficiency. Beside Vinsun, the Chinese company that has been mentioned in history section, the following three examples are off-site construction that will be transported as part or complete houses to its destination. This is very close to traditional, to the first 3D printers, actually, that project also scaled up Dutch architects actually designed this 3D printer. You can actually live on top of it, or putting actually the material on top of it in. It has a maximum build of 1.6, 1.6 to 4.5 meters per piece. And it has used plant-based printing materials. It is formerly known as Camo Maker, and they are now working on a life-size 3D printed canal house in Amsterdam on the canal. Is the final will be 700 square meters, and it will comprise a workshop area, the XL3D printer itself, a cafe, and an exhibition area. And it will be completed, they say, in 2018. I don't know if it's already finished. Could be. Then I chose that project here. I see the problem. Okay, sorry, I didn't see that. This was a bit too stretched there. The ONL, the Oak Ridge National Laboratory, have designed an innovative single-room building module. The research project named Additive Manufacturing Integrated Energy, AMI, uses 3D printing to build a tiny house and a vehicle. And the vehicle and the house are connected to the house is connected to a natural gas powered hybrid electric vehicle to produce and consume and store renewable energies. In total, the AMI project, from research through design, manufacturing, and assemblings, took 9 months in total. The building incorporates low-cost vacuum-insulated panels into an additive manufactured shell. The vacuum-insulated panels consisted of ABS, a well-known printing material for also the smaller printer. It is planned to use locally available materials and utilize more cost-saving techniques. The project emerged out of fundamental question concerning access to and use of energy in climate change and increasing demand for renewable energy sources and an uncertainty in balance of centralized versus distributed energy resources. In addition, more than 1.3 billion people worldwide have no access to an electric grid, and for another additional billion people, the grid access is unreliable. So this is the thought, to have it actually so decentralized and close that actually you produce your own energy and have a car and a home to live in. So this one I chose, I'm not sure if this actually is a 3D, if the parts are 3D printed, but I really do like the concept or the idea around. It's actually, Dome House is a Japanese construction project, and it assembles houses from parts, and each of the part weighs just 70 kilogram. Pieces have various shapes and can be, depend on how they are assembled, can have various shapes. I just took one picture. There are many more examples. They have many more parts, and that is. I really like the idea that down there is a little town they built actually from it. I do not like the material. It's polyurethane. Resin, so it's not the nicest material you can live in, I believe, while they advertising it as very good and isolating, but I believe it isolates too much because you start sweating in a plastic house, I believe. However, I like the shape of it, and I like the way that you can also 3D print. Actually, these parts are easy to 3D print. Yeah. So, the pros and cons. I collected the pros. It has fast and accurate construction. The 3D printer transfers the digital model into a physical one. When I do 3D printing, it's never happened, but probably with bigger printers it does. reduce the labor costs. 3D printer does most of the work for minimal human effort. It reduces waste generation as components can be printed to order during the construction phase. Those that are not used can be recycled. Reduced health and safety risk by replacing dangerous jobs on site with printing processes. It's environmentally friendly. Recycled products can be used to produce filaments for the 3D printers if you use recyclable materials, because sometimes it's not possible. People will in time be able to construct homes to suit their own tastes. So the buildings can be designed in almost any shape. So the cons of it is it reduces the employee numbers in the industry, since the 3D printing does most of the work. It limited, you have limited number of materials can be used in one or other nozzles you create for a 3D printer, so you can have limitations. But I hope there is in the future a development that we go into the filament itself, because I believe concrete is not the way to go. I'm very strong supporter of hempcrete, so I'm actually looking for a possibility to 3D print hempcrete, because I think that's a very healthy way of living in a house with hempcrete. However, back to the transportation, storage of the printer on site can be an issue. Higher risk, any errors in the digital modeling can result into plumbing issues on site during the printing or in the construction phase. Conventional product manufacturing companies and plant renting companies could suffer from as their products are no longer required. So probably they need to have then 3D printer in the stock or in the assortment. Many companies still use toxic and unsustainable materials in construction areas, which is harmful to the builders, the environment, and the health of the residents. For example, concrete, polyurethane foam, and expanding polystyrene. Okay. A bit more about the filaments. I'm short on time now. I actually mentioned that already, that many of the materials used at the moment are not the way to go. We actually need to find ways to create plant-based, fast-growing plant-based boards, for example, or techniques in which we can use hemp again for also for walls and clay mixtures and so on and so forth. I put some examples here. There's clay PLA. PLA is a starch-based filament. That's what I use for my art sculptures at home with my 3D printer. So it is actually plant-based. And it is recyclable, so you can heat it up, it will melt again. You can put it back into the cycle. This is really possible, it's very nice. Hempcrete, bamboo. I saw bamboo boards and also bamboo filaments are existing. Then usually there is a mixture of different materials, and I think there's a big space for development at the moment because there are not many of those. Usually, as seen, the most of them use concretes. So stone pebbles, shells, and limestone. There's one example here, it's Mireko. It's an Australian firm that actually started now to 3D print hempcrete panels, and the panels are going to be used to create houses. That's also in the development at the moment. It also can be used for floors, roofs, and interiors. So the final project is the one I mentioned, or I have spoken before, that uses subtractive manufacturing, is WikiHouse. WikiHouse CC is the webpage. It's an additive process, but an open. It's not an additive process, but the open source set and construction information for building components, which can be downloaded, manufactured, and sampled using local, commonly available materials and equipment. It's a low-tech prefabrication which requires little training. The WikiHouse plugin for Google SketchUp enables users to generate cutting files for components, which can be manufactured from standard sheet materials such as plywood using a CNC machine. The components are then assembled in with joints formed using pegs and wedges. The starting frame and cladding panels are raised and assembled by hand. Then the service and the windows can be installed. It is claimed that the chase of a single-story house can be built in a day, but I did that. I went to Holland last year, and I participated in building a house like that, and it took us 2 weeks. So, and we were 8 people, so it is not really... there are some pictures actually of the house we built, so it took a bit longer than it's often like that, I guess. Okay, for the future development, I believe as also mentioned before, I think an open source gantry house, 3D printing system would be very nice, as much as retrofit systems, including the software, because to control the crane, you can't do that by hand. So the crane needs to be automated as much as then the nozzle or the retrofit part of it. So we can use actually conventional construction systems to do 3D printing, as would be one good one. Free available methods of producing filaments for 3D printing and CNC boards. Also before mentioned, there's a lot of space for development in that direction. WikiHouse Design that can use to create hempcrete houses, because hempcrete houses, the walls are not structural walls. They're very good for thermal, and they are very breathable and very alive, I would say. But they are not structural, so you need actually a frame of a house. So WikiHouse could actually, with sheets, probably also made by bamboo or by hemp, could then build actually the frame, and between the frame you set up the walls. That would be also a nice project. And what I'm working on is a database for 3D and 2D designs for house-related items, including building parts, furniture, and household items. I would like to show you my project, what I started with, but I do that at the end if someone is interested. So that would be the library of things I'm working on. Okay.
Maybe we're going to go back to him at the end, so maybe we hold our applause until the very end. Can you hear me? Maybe turn it up a bit. I'm not that quiet usually. Now? Better? Good. Okay, so we're going to transition back to Jens at the end. Maybe just to link to this, so there were many really great projects that were mentioned that were proprietary, so that were industry standard but copyrighted. I am a specialist for urban development, in particular affordable housing and urban commons. The title of my presentation is based off of a book that I wrote about urban commons, Moving Beyond State and Market. So I'm going to be talking about state and market control. I'm going to keep it very brief because this is the too long didn't read version. So after all of this information that was so interesting, I don't want to pile on more. So first, we're having an affordable housing crisis in Berlin. Everybody's talking about the affordable housing crisis. What does that even mean? There is a definition. Affordable housing means that your housing costs are less than 30% of your household income after taxes. So let's break that down for Berlin. The median household income in Berlin in 2017 was 2,025 euros per month. That means that affordable housing for this household would cost no more than 675 euros per month. Now, there's a really nice mapping system at the Morgenpost, which allows you to put in your income and how large the apartment should be, and then it will tell you how much of your income percentage-wise you're going to have to spend on rent. And as you can see, our fictional household would only really be able to afford something out here outside of Spandau and in the last little pieces of Marzahn. So we're having a housing crisis. That median income household cannot afford to live anywhere inside the ring or find affordable housing anywhere, pretty much anywhere in the city. So there are state and market, again, going back to state and market instruments, which exist in Germany to promote or protect affordable housing. These are in two basic categories. These are my categories. I work in policy development sometimes when they ask me to. So first we have direct state regulation of the market. So urban planning department says we're going to do something and they write a regulation. Or you have indirect state regulation, so by increasing the supply of affordable housing. And there are basically three ways to do that. First, you have rent capping, so German, the Mietpreisbremse. I'll talk about that in a moment. We have changes to rent increases due to modernization, so how much the landlord is allowed to flip over onto your rent when they add insulation to the outside, or add an elevator, or add floor heating. It's being reduced from 11 to 8% as of the 1st of January. And also the creation of protected areas, lower rent areas, so Milieuschutzgebiete. Not commenting on the effectiveness of any of these topics. We'll get to that in a moment. So in the indirect state regulation, so increasing the supply, we have subsidies for construction of social housing with limited time, so temporary occupancy controls. So this is essentially the West German post-war model of social housing. The government gave a subsidy to a private construction company. They build housing, which is social housing, for 30 years, and when the 30 years are up, those buildings go onto the free market. This was the problem in Kreuzberg about 5 years ago, when all of a sudden all of the social housing around Cottbusser Tor suddenly had incredible rent increases, because nothing happened with the households. It was a problem with the fact that these rent occupancy controls were suddenly gone. Then we have building municipally owned housing. So a municipal housing company like WBM would construct housing, so kommunaler Wohnungsbau is how everybody talks about it. Yes, we need more kommunaler Wohnungsbau. Or we have stipulations for affordable housing quotas in new construction, so a normal construction project, but 25% of it has to be rental and has to be Sozialwohnungen, so with an affordable contingency, so an affordable occupancy control. The Berlin model stipulates officially that 25% of all new housing projects should have the social housing, you know, social rent prices. The reality is a bit different. So, like I said, not all of these are very effective. If you're going to put a rule into effect, usually you need to have some sort of a penalty if the rule is broken. That's not the case, for example, with the rent capping that was put into effect, which you can see in the next slide. So we have the a graph of rent price development in Neukölln and Wedding, two districts in the city which are really extremely, they're at risk of high gentrification and displacement of low-income families and low-income households. And what you can see is the vertical line is where the rent cap was introduced. And what you can see is that the rents were increasing. 100% is the baseline, so where the rents were at in 2012. And it's a percentual increase relative to 2012. And what you can see is that the angle of the line goes to about 45 degrees just 3 months after the rent capping was in. And that's because the burden of proof that the rent is actually too high is on the new tenant. So you move in and sue your landlord immediately. I don't know anybody who does this. I've actually heard of it. Think of one case that went through and she won. But the thing is, you have to know the contract of the person who just moved out. You have to have it as proof on paper. So you have to get the person who lived there before you to give you their rental contract. And then you have to go to court with your new landlord right after moving. Yeah, no. Also, high turnover in these areas. This is where a lot of students are moving in, young professionals, as they get pushed out of other neighboring districts. So typical people being displaced from Kreuzberg, moving to Neukölln, people being displaced from Prenzlauer Berg, moving to Wedding. From Friedrichshain moving to Lichtenberg. So basically we have three types of housing in the market. We have privately owned housing, which can be either regulated, for better or worse, for more effective or less effective, or basically unregulated, depending. I mean, if you have the house right outside of the Milieuschutzgebiet, you really got bad luck, because that means that that landlord sees what's happening on the other side, where the other guys are not allowed to put in the luxury flooring and the attic build out. And he says, damn it, I got to get this while I can, because that Milieuschutzgebiet might be extended tomorrow. We also have municipal housing, so you can move into, Deutsches Wohnen. Unfortunately, these housing companies do get privatized from time to time, and then suddenly you're in the top group again, so run by the market forces. And third, we have cooperatives. Yay! And this is where I see the biggest potential to increase the supply of housing that's not primarily under control of the state or market. So this is what I'm working on right now. A political scientist, and we also have another author working with us, are working on a project called the Urban Commons Cookbook, which is coming out at the end of the year under Creative Commons license, which was crowdfunded. And we are working on sort of the backbone of how to create cooperative projects, so commons projects. And we interviewed several different types of resources, including Freifunk, which is how I ended up here today. And we also looked at mobility and energy sources and housing. So going over to our friendly Wiki House example, here from Wiki House New Zealand, Basically, a house of this type has three components which can be hacked: technology, the buildings, and the land. So we're talking about the technology. It would be, for example, the materials or the filaments. Are they proprietary or not? The software, is it open source? The designs themselves, which Jens will talk about in a moment, and also the assembly system itself. So everything from the software through the programming through to the actual hardware and the filament used to create the models, it can all be designed in an open source way. It doesn't have to be Silicon Valley and venture capital. With the buildings themselves, it's totally possible, and there are many examples of cooperative housing structures. So it would be possible to have multifamily housing where each tenant has a share or a set of shares depending on the size of the apartment. Each person has one vote, and you have a consensus and a cooperative way of organizing it. So not profit oriented. The basic principles behind commons are that the people using the resources decide about how the resources are used, and they're not profit oriented. Usually they're direct democratic, but not always. You can also have a village of single family houses. We'll get to that with land, and hybrids are also possible. So the idea of creating modules, which are then stacked, for example, into a larger building within a framework, would also be possible, like containers. I don't know if any of you played Connect 4 as kids. It was a typical game in the United States where you dropped little tokens in and they lined up into four. I like to think of the modular housing. You just set up a frame of I-beams and then drop the modules in. Finally, we have the idea of land. So a community land trust is a commons-based organization of land ownership, which again follows the cooperative model. Another example, which is very typical, which is also especially typical in Switzerland, in the Zurich model, is the long-term lease of public land. So this is something that I think Berlin, I'm going to say it in a very sort of generalized way, but Berlin hasn't understood that through the long-term lease of public lands, you get to keep the public land and also make back all of the money you would have gotten from selling the land repeatedly. So Berlin wouldn't be in debt if they would stop selling off their land to the highest bidder and instead put it in the Pacht system. Because by charging, for example, 2 to 3% interest over 60 years, you can make back the value of the land, and you still own the land, therefore you can extend the contract, and then everything from there on out is money in the bank. And of course you have the idea of cooperative ownership. Other than a community land trust, there are other models of cooperative land ownership, and I'm just going to leave that there. And I've already mentioned the book, so I'm going to let Jens maybe speak about the Library of Things. Is it all right? Do we have another 3 minutes? Yeah?
Okay.
Let me just get this. Let me put you back
on. Oh, it's all right.
Go.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Is it on?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. One little remark to Wiki House. They're actually working on a software at the moment that makes it available to create modular houses. So that this is already in work with them, with their own software. Okay. It won't take long, just in a short. So I'm working on the Library of Things, LOT. is a database for designs for additive and subtractive productions of parts and items around house building, interior and exterior. I put it on online on bitsandbobs.cc. That's the online representation of the library, which is actually then the second part. If you can see that on there, you have the library of things. And I have I work now on this web page where people can access this database. My personal dream is one day it will be kind of part of the public library, because it does not need to have only books in the library. It can have things as well, so people can actually go there, modify and change their models. It is similar to I don't know if you know Thinkiverse. Is it called, in which you can download like 3D objects or designs of 3D objects and print them out. So the 3D models with the capability to export designs for 2DX format, what you need for CNC machines, or as a STL format for 3D printers. Connections to other models that are needed for a piece of furniture, or the description of the designs and additional information such as the coder's name and or the user instructions. Once an interested maker signed up and logged in, that was number one, yes. Once an interested maker is signed up and logged in, the model can be downloaded. You know, it can be modified and changed and uploaded again. And I would like to keep it in the zero license, because I believe that people can put their name or their credits into the code. So that would be then kind of the polite way of keeping it there. And if you modify the model, you just set your name underneath and set modified date, the date, and then you put it underneath, so it keeps. It's also good actually to keep the names in the code, because when you want to build furnitures for your room, you want to have probably the same style, and some designer has probably did similar designs, table, chairs, and so on and so forth. So people can rely on the name to search for it. So it can be downloaded, and then it can actually. Either way, you have your own machines, CNC machines, 3D printers, or you go to a workshop that has them. And I believe that is coming in the next years. There will be more and more. Like, momentarily, we have fab labs a lot with the CNC machines. The CNC machine evolution of this technology hasn't finished yet. I myself figured I could use a laser to track actually the wooden sheet to configure a CNC machine. At the moment, you need to do that by hand. I also have a prototype 3D printer. I do need to level the base also with screwdriver and by hand. And this evolution went on for the last 10 years, and now the 3D printers generally have an automatic configuration of the base, so it is flat. And the basic is OpenSCAD, and OpenSCAD is used by other similar databases. And you can have this program, this open source program, and you can have it on Linux, Mac, Windows. You have a web browser application. You can work there. Or you have, I found lately, an Android version as well, not as finished, also in development, as the original software. And it is actually a script-based coding, a script-based CAD software. I don't know if you know. Does anyone know OpenSCAD? I don't know. No, it's a very small software, and it's actually very simple coding, very simple syntax. And I would also love to teach that to kids, because it is so easy actually to grab the starting points. But you can make, with modules, you can make very extensive and complicated or complex models out of it. So the current state of the development is I need to finalize the basic modules because CNC machines have certain limitations. For example, a CNC machine can't have cornered cuts because it is actually a drill, and a drill is round, so you have to have certain standard movements of the machine that actually gives the possibility to stick things together. And I at the moment I design these extra movements of the machine that can be then very easily implemented into your design, so you don't need to bother about it. You just call them by including it, and then you can call them like libraries work in coding then now, or class work. The web page, website platform. This is actually a Python Django based software web page, and I'm not a professional coder, so I need to find people who are interested in helping me on that stage or in that development. I want to create a range of example designs and tutorials to make it easy for people who are interested to create their own designs to get on with it. And we have a lot of fab labs actually here in Berlin as well, and I will also start in one of them too. A work with other designs then, and maybe a browser-based version of OpenSCAD on the site, so people even don't need to install their own software. They just go to the browser and can start working there, and a language translation. Thank you for listening. That was it, actually. If you're interested to see it, I have it on my computer, the web page, and I have examples as well with me. So if you're interested in that, LOT.
Maybe mention that those are things you're looking for people to help you with.
Yes, I'm actually looking for people to help me with it, because the coding side of things, I'm okay with OpenSCAD, but Django, Python, to have actually the web page working with all the, because there are a collection of personal data and so on and so forth, I need to be sure that everything is safe and everything is okay and, PC. So I'm not getting into trouble when I put it online then or make it official. So I'm looking for Django, Python guys who probably are interested in working on a library of things based on OpenSCAD designs. Yeah, thank you.
I guess there will be plenty of time to meet with Jens and Mary. A warm applause for them again. It was great. And I guess we're directly diving into the Q&A session, I guess. So, do we have any questions here? Come on. Anybody? Yeah, there in the front.
I wonder about the price ranges. When you had this list of pros and cons in the first third or something, you didn't mention about anything about the price ranges of the material, and I think there's a reason.
Okay. Hello?
Yeah.
Okay. prices about the material, I'm not sure. There is also not mentioned on that side. The range of 3D printers are from about 50,000 to a million, very wide range of prices for these printers. There are services, some of them are services in which you can actually rent the system. But about materials, I unfortunately can't answer that question.
Yeah, because I was referring to the materials, because we all know the small 3D printing, and they're actually in comparison, the material is quite expensive. So I was wondering about that and that scale. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
So we have another question on the back. One second.
So you said you you had like libraries to develop houses from. Is that correct? So the general question is like if you have houses like this particular pattern or whatever, who is going to take care that my instantiation my version of that house is going to be statically stable? Like, do you need an architect or a Bauingenieur to? So I'm not saving on that end.
Oh, is the, hello?
When I went to Holland
Hello? Okay. When I went to Holland, there have been there were three architects actually who worked on this house, and they changed the designs and so on and so forth. But the goal is actually that you don't need an architect to create a house. You can do that yourself. And as it is, it is actually supported by architects who work with the software. They work at the moment on it as well. Then you just need the verification, so the legal agreement. But the architect themselves, if they once know the system and they know also have contact probably with architects there, there's no problem actually then. That's probably a bit cheaper to just get this design on the paper than an architect go into the design of the house. So if you just have that one, and you know, I just won't need a sign, and it is already known probably under architects as well to use this modular or single house designs, then they know that it's going to work. So there will be, I think, less of a problem than financially as well.
Okay. I would also say that I spend a lot of time with architects, for better or worse. I'm a landscape architect by training, and I would say that there's, in particular in the experimental architecture and anarchist architects, there's a lot of interest in this, and they're also quite interested in supporting this type of work. So I think actually I was really surprised when I was doing the research for this talk that no one else had brought these two things together yet. Because I find it so logical, and we met when I was giving a talk in a tiny house, and commons came up about, you know, we buy the land, we make a community land trust, we make a village of tiny houses, and we have our little anarcho syndicate. Yes. It really turned into a little leftist party in that tiny house. It was a party of five people because it was tiny. But yeah, I mean, I really feel like also, the idea of creating modular housing and repeatable building structures, which are structurally okay, is also, you know, so that other people can do it, non-architects can create their own housing, is sort of an emancipatory dream of many people. So,
one more. I also like actually. We talked about it, especially about the modular system. So when you start as one, you have a little house, then you have a partner you can extend, because you can take off the corners of the house and you just put another bit on it, and then you have children, you can go upwards. And that's also the whole idea, that you have actually start with a little money, you have a little house, and then you have a partner, you put your money together, you get another bit, so you can actually over time you can extend your house, which is actually a good point when you start with small. So over time you can actually extend your own house.
Just an input to the regulations topic. Like in other countries, at least in Poland, for example, you can build a house up to 30 square meters without any allowance or so. You just have to declare it, And when you don't get any feedback from the government and so on, then you can just start building a house without any architects and so on. So I think they, in the other countries, it will be more interesting, the whole project and so on.
Okay. I'm there.
Yeah, so thank you for this, because I'm always interested in the sort of pan-European and also sort of international perspective. I am an American, as you might have heard, and I've been living here for 11 years, so I'm pretty deep in the German system at this point. But Poland is really interesting for that and also other reasons, with other urban development issues that are going on there. I can also say that the example for urban commons that I have in the Urban Commons Cookbook, which is a book that's coming up at the end of the year, is called the Kalkbreite. It's in Zurich, and it follows the Zürcher model. They forced me to say it that way. And basically, they have a really interesting architecture where they have apartments of different sizes done throughout this building. And then they have joker rooms, which you can rent additionally to your, you can add it on to your apartment in case you suddenly have a different family situation. You have a kid, or you have a parent who has to come and live with you and be taken care of, or if you split up and somebody has to not sleep on the couch, needs their own space. These rooms have their own bathroom, but they're not autonomous. They don't have a kitchen, they're not a separate apartment, but they can be added on and they can be rented for up to 4 years, which is a really interesting spatial understanding. They also have in this, they have over 260 residents, one of which is in a super household of 65 people who have a cook. They share a cook who cooks then lunch and dinner, or maybe just dinner. Sorry, Kalkbreite, if I'm messing it up. And they have a really interesting, they're experimenting with new forms of living communally. So those guys are really the hardcore, they explained to me, they're the hardcore of the Kalkbreite. Anarcho-hippies, yay!
Do I see any more questions from the audience? Yeah. Well, another brave one. 1 second.
Thank you both for the talk. My question is, so you talk more about urban developments, and the examples that you had, Jens, were, as far as I could see, more oriented towards small houses, like single family houses. So my question is, are these 3D printed houses also, is this also applicable to like urban housing, like even skyscrapers or things like that? You had this one 5-story apartment complex. How does it work for these urban buildings?
I think, like Vincent does it work? Like Vincent does it, you actually print, you have a gantry printing system somewhere in the city. You print the parts and then you transport the parts and you stack them up. I think that's the way to go. Or if you, like, I know from Cabby Spacey, I'm sorry if I say it wrong, but there's a project here in Berlin. They actually, it's not printed, or it is also not set together. It's actually made of wood, but there are little cabins, and they actually want to populate the roofs of Berlin. So they actually built that also in one facility, and then they put that on the truck with a crane, and then drive. Cabby Spacey or something, Cabin Spacey or something is the name of that project. And they actually have now a prototype also, this is in Berlin here. And they, about the smaller houses, there are also spaces in the city you can look and find spaces where you actually can have smaller parts, like 25 square meters, like little cabins, especially on the roof, for example. So, but yeah, I think in bigger style, this is rather building parts and transporting them and assembling them on site, because everything is built up. So I don't think, if you don't have a lot of space where you can build this gantry system straight on and build it for there, you need to have concrete parts, because then you can, you know, put it together. But the production time is shorter with 3D printers then.
And I would also say that in my mind, there's also this idea of bringing together new industry and old industry. So I don't know if you're aware of the NDSM in Amsterdam. It's an enormous old wharf building. It's 5,000 square meters. It's just a building with a roof. That's it. And they built a container village within it. So same concept, just without shipping containers. I mean, shipping containers have become a little passé now. This was a couple, almost 10 years ago that they began. But this idea that one could mount a gantry in an old factory building, which is designed to have this type of structure in it, and then use that to extrude houses within an existing roof, is something that I think is a really potentially very interesting idea, in particular for areas that are shrinking and trying to move back into themselves. I'm working on a research project for the German Marshall Fund looking at vacancy and in particular in old industrial areas. So it's something I think about a lot. Again, also on roofs, as long as it's not a structural problem, then yay. Let's put a tiny house on top of every Berliner old tenement building. I mean, they're made of stone and they've already survived two world wars. Let's just do this. Not all of them. They have a Dachboden. We just have to put some steel in there and do it.
Okay.
Wait.
There's no reason that the Dachgeschoss has to be for the luxury housing. We could make it an emancipated space, open source housing. Sorry.
Yes, let's do this. Okay, so I guess we're wrapping this up for tonight. Okay, so, okay, thank you for this very, very interesting talk and inspiring talk. Thank you, Mary, and thank you, Jens, and to all. I'm getting a signal from the back. Something? Nothing? Okay, so thank you all for your attention and have a nice evening. And if there are any Python developers here, I guess you will find your way to the good people. And yeah, have a nice evening. Bye bye. See you next time.